Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm Patrick Castillo, and I have the great pleasure of introducing you to the 2014 season's Carte Blanche Concerts, Music at Menlo's signature series of artist-curated recital programs. Each year, Music at Menlo invites a cadre of chamber music's finest recitalists and chamber musicians to design a program highlighting their particular musical interests and indulging their most audacious creative impulses. In previous seasons, the Carte Blanche series has featured such memorable concerts as Colin Carr's performance of the complete Bach cello suites, Randall Scarlatta and Gilbert Kalisch's performance of Schubert's Winterreise, the Borromeo String Quartet's complete Bartok quartet cycle, as well as marathon recital programs by pianists Alessio Bax and Stephen Prutzman, violinist Suvin Kim, cellist Lawrence Lesser, and more. This season's Carte Blanche series promises to continue the festival's tradition of unforgettable musical experiences. We have four Carte Blanche concerts lined up, beginning with the Escher String Quartet's performance of the complete quartets of Alexander von Zemlinsky on Wednesday, July 23. On Sunday, July 27, pianist Arnaldo Cohen makes his Music at Menlo debut with a program of music by Bach, Brahms, and Chopin. Violinist Yura Lee and pianist Dina Weinstein follow on Wednesday, July 30, with a dazzling program of Czech and Hungarian virtuoso works. And pianist Gilles von Sattel, following his festival debut last season, returns with a powerful recital program based on themes of nationalism and revolution. For the summer's final Carte Blanche concert, pianist Gilles von Sattel has modified a bold recital program originally presented at the Lucerne Festival last summer in Switzerland. The program offers works by Beethoven, Liszt, Leos Janáček, Camille Saint-Saëns, and the modern American composer Frédéric Chevsky. I spoke with Gilles about his program earlier this year.
So the program came together in a very late night Skype conversation when I was in Switzerland, and actually I had just played a version of this program, very loosely related, I guess, at the Lucerne Festival, because their theme, this edition in 2013, was revolution. So I had a program that incorporated that theme in various ways, and we were talking about doing something like that at Menlo, and we were also talking, of course, about Dvorak. And it seemed to me to be a happy intersection of things, because Dvorak really, if you look at his life, you know, the world was a completely different place when he died than when he was born, and must have seemed quite apparent to him, I think, especially on his trip to America, which Menlo will be dealing with extensively, I'm sure. So what we have here is some revolutionary music that has to do also with a sense of rising nationalism and freedom in Eastern Europe, and even touching on some elements of Americana as well. So we're going to start from Beethoven, which is a great starting point for any kind of liberating experience, I think, in music. And I think these two pieces in particular, these two works in particular, are extremely liberating in Beethoven's own opus. So we have the Opus 126 Bagatelles, which are actually the last thing he wrote for the piano. And we have the Moonlight Sonata, or Opus 27 number 2, as he would have thought of it, Sonata Quasi Una Fantasia. And these two works, they're from completely different periods in his life, but still they're both very experimental. The Bagatelles are, we think of Beethoven, or, you know, often Beethoven is that kind of incredibly imposing figure for us and for composers who followed him, writing massive works, the kind of work where you have struggle, you have at the end some catharsis, some incredible revelation, you spend, you know, 45 minutes in the concert hall and you're transformed at the end. These pieces are tiny. The Bagatelles are, each one is a couple of minutes, and in just a few brushstrokes, he manages to create little jewels, these really wonderful little character pieces, basically. They're full of absolutely quirky humor, bizarre turns and twists, pauses, hesitations, extreme use of register, lots of things that you find in the quartets that were to follow this. Thank you. but really, really charming pieces and just really genial atmosphere throughout. So those are a little bit unusual. And then we have the Moonlight Sonata, written a couple decades before in 1801, I think, which is from a period where Beethoven, starting from Opus 26 in the piano sonatas, really embarks on what he called a new path. And so these works between Opus 26 and the Opus 31 sonatas are really trying new ideas. And the Moonlight, for all kinds of reasons, is a revolutionary work from its opening movement. That's the super famous, like one of the most famous, I guess, classical music pieces of all time, is this first movement of the Moonlight Sonata. Then there's this really bizarre second movement, not bizarre in its own because it's a charming little scherzo, but it just exists in this weird destabilizing position between these two movements, outer movements that are so, well, Liszt actually, Franz Liszt called it a flower between two chasms or two abysses. And it's so brief and it's so charming, and it's between these two just bleak statements. Movement is really the heart of the piece. Tremendously violent, energetic work, very, very kinetic, extremely repetitive too in its motion, which is something we'll come back to, I think, in the rest of the program. Beethoven, we have somebody who's using the piano as a laboratory. It's really, you can point to often to, especially in the piano sonatas, it's extremely convenient because you have such a spectrum of his work from when he was young to the end of his productive life. And you can almost always point, okay, Opus 26, there's a funeral march, that's going to show up in the Eroica, the introduction, the role of the introduction, the chromaticism in there leading to the... I mean, there's many things he tries, things like the Appassionata and Waldstein pointing forward. And I think, again, you know, I said this a little bit, but to say, you know, in 126 in the Bagatelles, we have a look at the quartets, right? With these very small, fragmented things that somehow also... He called it a cycle, actually, Opus 126. So, okay, for Beethoven, it's the laboratory. For the Moonlight also is a great example of that. And then the next piece we have is by a man who played the Moonlight Sonata almost at every chance he could get, which was Franz Liszt. And this is one of the pieces from his cycle, Harmonie Poétique et Religieuse, which is a big, I think, 10, it depends how you classify, but either 9 or 10, I think, movements. This is Funérailles, subtitled October 1849. And this was written, it's a sort of huge elegy, lament, funeral piece, written in memory of people who he knew who had been killed at the end of the Hungarian Revolution in 1849. 1848 was a tremendously turbulent year in Europe, and this piece really can be thought of as the music of a world that's changing. It's got Hungarian modes and inflections almost throughout. You can hear the clamor of funeral bells, a very personal, beautiful lament. and a very, very interesting ending. Liszt was, I think it's always interesting to notice how often Liszt avoided the dominant at the end of his pieces. So there's always this feeling of unsettled ending where things haven't really been settled in some way. Franz Liszt's pianism is all over the map because in his own life too, he doesn't know what he wants to be. Like he's an absolutely fascinating, and I find him like a very appealing figure. This piece, Funérailles, is written right when he decides to stop concertizing. Mm-hmm. And he had been, by all accounts, was the greatest virtuoso of his age, maybe of all time, was really struck by Paganini's virtuosity, decided to he's going to do the same thing on the piano, revolutionize the instrument. And so went on these tours playing repertoire that nowadays, you know, we would consider quote unquote trashy. He did play the Beethoven Moonlight Sonata more than any other work of Beethoven's, but we know that he added lots of stuff to the first movement and arpeggios and figurations because it probably just wasn't dramatic enough. But to his credit, you know, he really brought people to love the instrument, and he also was responsible for the propagation of amazing repertoire. When we get to Funérailles, we have a different kind of music, though, because he's not writing for public consumption anymore. And this leads to this really interesting thing of Liszt knowing, you know, he gets terrible reviews for his music at this point in his life. So he's decided to go to Weimar and just become a composer, like dedicate his life to the music of the future, to teaching, to changing music, basically. And all he's getting is miserable reviews, and Robert and Clara Schumann are calling him a miserable composer. And, you know, and throughout, you know, he's writing this kind of music that I would describe as, it's almost always orchestral for the piano. I mean, at least in this case, in Funérailles, it feels tremendously orchestral. I mean, you have just these massive, massive chords, obviously from somebody who knows how to write for the instrument. But I have to say, never writes things that are that difficult for the instrument. At least there are some famous exceptions, but Liszt really knew what he was doing in terms of the piano. And as a pianist, like, I find Chopin much more difficult, you know, technically. And that's interesting also, because I think he's not, again, a little bit maybe like Beethoven, he wants to be writing major orchestral pieces. That's really his vision of what it means to have arrived as a composer. So he does write lots of orchestral tone poems. You know, it's a mixed record, but in Funérailles we hear someone who wants to write great music, like really a music that will last. And also for me, something I love is just the chromaticism, which then leads us to our next composer, who is Janáček, a countryman of Dvořák's. And this piece is the Sonata 1.x.1905.
Just to explain, that's how the Sonata of Janáček's was published. Sonata 1.x.1905.
Which is from another year that is very turbulent in European history. We fast forward to 1905. It's different than the Liszt. It's not like a ceremonial remembrance or a giant kind of... The Liszt sounds like the death of a nation or of a people. This is the death of one man who's described as a common laborer in the preface to the sonata that he added in 1924. Because actually, Janáček, it's incredible. He actually thought this piece was apparently not good because he threw it into a river after he was done writing it.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's true. And the reason we still have it is because the woman who premiered it kept the part, and then she found it again. And he was going to write a third movement to it, but he didn't, which is amazing because it's actually, to our ears now, it sounds like such an instant classic. Yeah, so this piece is a much more personal kind of lament and memory of an event. The first movement is called The Presentiment, and it's very beautiful, very unsettled. The second movement is called The Death, presumably the death of the laborer, it's actually very gentle and quite beautiful, except for a part in the middle where obviously something happens. The music gets very, very agitated, and there's a sort of a motor pattern in the left hand of the piano that can, I think of it as a heartbeat, but it's very, very affecting, and it's in a different pulse than the rest of the movement, and it feels like a rush of blood. So that's our pieces that are directly involved with social unrest, with that kind of thing, with a rising sense of nationalism. This, I should say, this demonstration that this man was killed in was to try to establish a Czech university in Brno, which was unsuccessful at the time. Then we move to, this is going to be the next piece after this music will be as disorienting as the second movement of the Moonlight Sonata, I think, for the audience and for me. We're moving to the Saint-Saëns' Afrique Fantasy, or Africa Fantasy, a solo piano version of a piece he wrote in 1891 for orchestra and piano. This is the kind of music that we don't find anymore on at least orchestral programs for various reasons. It's musical tourism. So Franz Liszt, who we owe so much to in the tradition for piano, made this kind of music extremely popular because of hits like The Spanish Rhapsody. Mm-hmm. The idea is that you hear this stuff. It's like watching a travel documentary at home or something, where you don't have to leave your house, but you still feel like you were in Spain. And Saint-Saëns in Africa does exactly this. And it's interesting, too, because obviously when we're dealing with Dvorak and Janáček and these composers, we're dealing a lot with using folk elements in a classical Western idiom, or at least kind of format language. And in this case, you know, you can see in the Janáček and in the Liszt where it's done in a very emotional, kind of very heartfelt, as genuine as it gets. And here, Saint-Saëns does use Egyptian music and Tunisian music. However, he uses it strictly to create champagne. I mean, it's really just, like, you can hear it. It's the sound of, to me, the sound of colonization. I mean, and I think it's useful to have that on a program like this because, it's oddly charming, and like he's really good at it, and it's nice to have a different perspective on what's possible. Piece was written during a cruise through the Nile, which was, I presume, in a lot of comfort and luxury. This maybe out of everything on the program is the real showpiece, because actually the Liszt piece is more of a tone poem. It has its famous, you know, octave passage that's very difficult, but it's more of a sweeping emotional creation than Africa, which is really one set of he moves smoothly through one sort of technical problem after another, and everything has to sound charming, right? Which is easier said than done. And then we get to the last piece on the program, which is by the American composer Frederick Jevsky, Winsboro Cotton Mill Blues. This is actually quite a famous piece now. It's like a real standard in the piano repertoire of the last part of the 20th century. It makes use of all kinds of techniques. It's extremely understandable, though, because of its primary point, its mission, which is to take the blues, the Winsboro Cotton Mill Blues, and put them in their place of origin. I mean, the blues in classical music often have a history of being used as a source of exoticism, right? There's Rhapsody in Blue, there's Ravel, you know, we'll use it like in the violin sonata or in the piano concerto in G major, to create a sense of, it's exoticism is the word, it's something that's other, it's sensual, it's from another place, it's exotic. Here it is not exotic, it is the music of the people, the music of the workers. And what you hear right away is a grinding noise of a factory, which grows and grows and grows in volume as you get closer and closer to the factory, to the Winsboro Cotton Mill in South Carolina. And the pianist in the opening part of the piece is literally turned into a machine. You have to just play these clusters. It's actually quite difficult, too, because you have to have melodies come out with your elbows and things like that. And the stamina issue in this piece, if you really go for it, is really something. You know, you're becoming, you're mechanized, and you're creating the sound of a cotton mill. When this eventually dies away, there's a Art Tatum-like part where the blues appear in a very sentimental, beautiful polyphonic passage, which is thoroughly composed but sounds improvised. And then that dissolves into a fugue section where you hear the winds, the tune, in a straight fugue that gets extremely difficult, actually. Before finally the piece ends in kind of a mad restatement of the tune over an ostinato bass, kind of like a boogie-woogie thing, and then the machine sound returns at the very end. So here we have source element folk music that's being used, again, in a way very different from Africa, where the goal is not to entertain or to delight in the inventiveness of the composer, although there's an amazing inventiveness. There is, you know, a lot of common stuff. Like, Bjefsky is a great pianist himself, and so is Saint-Saëns, you know, and they both have an incredible arsenal that they bring to the table. These are virtuoso pieces in the tradition of a Franz Liszt or a Beethoven who are pianist composers. Bjefsky is really, it's a great addition to the repertoire because it draws on so much. I mean, you have the clusters that you find in Charles Ives or in Cowell. Bjefsky himself says a lot of the piece he thought of Bach when he was writing in terms of like the polyphony, which is pretty relentless in the few parts where there's always some use of the tune that's coming, that's broken up, being played in another voice. There's lyrical playing in the blues section where it's very contemplative, even cantabile type playing. In like an 11-minute piece, there's so much. There's also a very, I think, like Bartok or Prokofiev-like approach to massive chords and rhythms in the piece. So you can't shake the feeling that here's somebody who knows the piano repertoire and has played the piano repertoire and immediately sort of thought, oh, this is going to work here, this is going to work here, I want this sound here. You know, it's somebody who's drawing on a lot.